Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Welcome to the Heritage Radio Network on Tour. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. Today we're broadcasting live from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival. My friends just dumped all the wine we drank last night. We want to thank the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage possible and to Charleston Wine and Food Festival for having everyone down here for the fifth year in a row. Our guest today is Nicole Marchese. Nicole is the winemaker at Farniente Winery in Napa, California. Welcome to the Grape Nation.
Happy to be here.
All right, Nicole, I think a lot of people know your wines, but they may not necessarily know who makes them. So give me a little background in your journey in life and wine that got you to currently the winemaker Farniente.
Sure. So I was at the University of California at Davis working on an unrelated science degree and not super happy, trying to find out what I liked. Ended up taking a job at the school newspaper and did an article about the viticulture and enology department. So I interviewed professors, found out there was this amazing way to use science, and took the intro class, changed majors, and just didn't look back. After school, I traveled and worked a few internships. I went to New Zealand and worked, and then came back. I was working in Sonoma, needing to find a full-time job, and ended up starting at Farniente in the lab as the enologist in 2005. So I've just hit my 15-year mark with the company just last month. I've been winemaker for 10 years. So
all right,
enologist, assistant, and then winemaker.
Okay. So lab 05, and yeah, then you move up the ranks.
Moved up the ranks, yep.
When was that moment that you knew wine was the thing you wanted to, you know, do? Was it at Davis or when you left?
You know, I think it really was at Davis. We had this, there was a class that we all called barbecue class. And it was a class that you got to take, and we'd have, it was an evening class, and we'd have a speaker come, winemakers would come talk to us, and then we'd all share wine and barbecue. Like, you'd bring your own food to barbecue, and we'd sit around. And so I think that feeling of, hey, this is science, which I love, but it's also people, and it's sharing, and it's coming together, and I knew that's what I wanted in my life.
Cool. So Beth Nickel, the proprietress of Farniente, obviously a woman, has been very pro-women in wine. You know, there's been a lot of women winemakers and women people there. Do you feel that the rest of Napa Valley is up to that level? I mean, are women getting a fair shake?
I think specifically, like, I can only speak to what it's like to be a woman on the production side of things. And I have never felt held back,
right,
by being a woman. I think Farniente, the two previous winemakers for me there, were both women, so we've got a long history of that. And I have a lot of other women winemaker friends in Napa, so it hasn't felt like I had no one to turn to talk to. I think we're super progressive in California and super progressive in Napa, and just recognize that you recognize talent when you find it, regardless of whether or not it's a man or a woman.
So no real issue.
I haven't.
As far as doing what you need to do, being a woman was not an issue.
It has not been an issue.
Do you think being with Beth and the whole environment there makes things easier?
Yeah, I think that specifically at Farniente, it's a really it's a conducive environment for that. We support families, we support good work, we support each other, and so I think it's a great place to be a woman and a man, because we support the whole person in your whole life.
All right, so let's talk about family. You're a mom.
I am. Yep.
Full-time winemaker.
Full-time winemaker.
Two kids. And ironically, you can't even escape the world because your husband's in the business. Right? He's a winemaker?
Yes, he is a winemaker as well.
So when you're lying in bed staring at the ceiling, I mean, do you talk about anything other than wine?
Yes, we talk about, like, who's dropping the kids off for their soccer practice the next day.
So real mom stuff and all that.
I actually find it, it's really refreshing to have a partner who understands the challenges and who
That's great.
Who can really empathize. And also when I have... you know, I bring samples home, and his opinion really matters to me in my work. And so that's really great to have somebody...
Second palate.
And he brings his samples home, and I get to taste his, and so it's really collaborative at home.
But going back to my first question, being a mom, having the responsibility of taking care of kids, and I know guys, and you know guys, we don't know how to do everything, so obviously you're doing everything at home, maybe...
I am not, actually.
You're not? You
no.
let him do some stuff? So you don't have to worry about being a woman at a nickel or in the wine business?
No.
Like you said. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about Farniente.
Okay.
All right. Give me a little history of the winery, because, you know, we know there's zillions of wineries in Napa now, but Farniente has a pretty good history.
Yeah, Farniente is definitely steeped in history. So the winery was actually started in 1885. A man named John Benson came out to California and created the winery. The architect who built the winery, his name was Hamden McIntyre, and he built quite a few wineries in Napa. So if you go to the Culinary Institute, which is called Greystone, Hamden McIntyre did that. Chateau Montelena, Inglenook, and Trefet.
So he was a big guy, right?
Yeah, and when you go and you see these historic buildings, you can see the similarities in them. So 1885, it was originally called Farniente. Didn't survive Prohibition, so it became an abandoned building for many years. We still get some older folk from Napa who say, oh, I used to have the greatest parties in high school at Farniente because it was this abandoned stone
right.
building. We have different sort of parties there now.
Right.
But in the 1970s, late 70s, our modern founder, Gil Nickel, who came out from Oklahoma, fell in love with Napa, fell in love with winemaking, and wanted to create an iconic wine estate that would rival the great estates in France. And he really put his heart and soul into that, renovated the property. We're on the list of historic places, and started our current incarnation of Farniente with the 1979 Chardonnay.
So what was Gil's background?
So Gil came from the nursery business.
He did?
Yeah, so Greenleaf Nursery, which is a major commercial nursery, was his family's business.
In Oklahoma?
In Oklahoma.
Nothing to do with wine, vines, grafting, just regular nursery and all of that. Do we know why he was... you know, compelled to come out to Napa?
I think he came out to do some coursework. I never got the opportunity to meet him.
He passed away a few years ago.
All the stories, he was a lifelong learner, curious, really passionate, really dedicated to making things that last and that are beautiful and luxurious. And Napa just, I think just Napa just pulled him in.
Right. Let's talk about the wines. Interestingly, you concentrate on really a couple of varietals, right? The red and the white is basically Cab, and the white is Chardonnay, which are the classic and typical, you know, Napa wines and grapes.
Yep.
But everyone's making so much more. Why did it wind up that way?
We really wanted to be focused on those two grape varietals, so specifically Cabernet and Chardonnay. We wanted to be like a great estate in Bordeaux with our Cabernet, and we wanted to make a Chardonnay that rivaled the wines in Burgundy, that from day one. And we're very focused on doing what we do and doing it really well and not trying to spread ourselves too thin, you know what I
right.
mean? And anytime our business has wanted to branch out and try something new, instead of trying to just make everything under Farniente, which has its identity with Cabernet and Chardonnay,
right.
we've created new brands. And so our company actually has five individual brands with individual winemakers focused on different areas
so
of wine.
Nickel and Nickel, Dolce,
which is a late harvest
wine.
We have a Russian River Pinot Noir brand called En Route, and a new Napa Valley Cabernet called Bella Union.
So what I'm a little intrigued about is the Chardonnay is non-malolactic, right?
Correct.
Tell people before we go on what that means in wine and winemaking.
Okay. So what happens after primary fermentation, when the sugar is turned into alcohol, there's a secondary fermentation that can take place, and it's called malolactic fermentation. So that's when malic acid, which is like the crisp acid of an apple, if you think about how tart that is, to lactic acid, which is like the acid that's in milk, so a little bit softer profile. So we intentionally block that from happening, and that's been a style point for us since 1979. We haven't changed that. And what we really found was that Chardonnay coming from Napa Valley, which is a warmer climate, like we really need to retain acidity for freshness, for food pairing, and for ageability. So by preventing malolactic fermentation from happening, we really have a refreshing wine that's not too heavy and flat, and we have a wine that you can put down in your cellar and actually age it for several years.
Isn't it hard to argue that when people think of Napa Chards, they think of big, rich, buttery? This is absolutely
the
opposite style, right? Agree? But the cab that you make is kind of a polar opposite. It's a little bigger and more unctuous. How would you describe?
Yes, we want to make a nice, rich, ripe Cabernet, but I will say that it's not, we still play in the camp of having structure and freshness and classic cab characters that aren't too, that aren't over-extracted or not too alcoholic. We're still, with both wines, we walk a tightrope of power and elegance. You know, in the Chardonnay, there is still some richness and good viscosity and volume, but we've got acid that comes back on the end. And I would say the same thing with our Cabernet, where there is richness and deep, dark fruits, but it isn't heavy. It isn't so heavy in your mouth that you get tired. It also still has some good acid and freshness that brings it back on the back end.
Is this the wine that you always made? Because years and years ago, 90s, the wines got very big to appeal to the market. Now you're seeing a movement towards restraint. Some wineries have adjusted the type of wines. Has this pretty much been the style?
We've been fairly consistent in our style. I've had the luxury of getting to taste through lots of verticals of Farniente and verticals.
Older stuff and older
wines from our neighbors, and older wines from Bordeaux, which just like part of my education at Farniente has been like that. And one of the things that's really stuck out is that for a long time when we first started, we were chasing Bordeaux.
Right.
And then I feel like there was a point in the 90s, and it kind of happened at different points for different wineries, where we all kind of went, we don't need to chase Bordeaux. Bordeaux needs to chase us.
Like, right. And, be yourself. Yeah, be what
like,
you
this
can be.
Is what we, this is what we are. And now this is a truly Napa Valley Cabernet.
So we talked about the wines. Let's talk about what wine is, which is an agricultural product. It's a farm product. Talk to me a little about practices.
Okay.
In the vineyards. Let's talk about sustainability, any organics. You know, talk to me a little more when you get in the cellar about style. We describe the wines, but how do you get to that?
Okay.
So let's start out in the field.
Okay, so out in the field, we do have our own farming company. So we farm the majority of our own grapes and own quite a few of our own vineyards. And what that does is it really gives us great control over practices, over timing, and making sure that what's happening in the vineyard is exactly what we want to happen. We do farm organically. We're not certified. We're not certified because we just believe that organic farming is the right thing to do. There's healthier vines. It's better for the environment. It's better for us. So that's what we're going to do. And it doesn't matter to be certified or not, because we're going to do it because it's right. So we do farm organically. We have an incredible team in the vineyard. The home vineyards for our Chardonnay program are located in the southern part of Napa Valley in an area called Coombsville. So if you're in Napa and you go east to the base of the Vaca Mountains, we own quite a few vineyards there. And that's just a really tremendous place for Chardonnay. It's much cooler. You get the influence from the bay.
Right. Do you like a cooler climate for your Chardonnays?
We do. So Napa's warm, but we try to find the coolest spots. And
right.
I think you just retain freshness, aromatics. It's a really special spot. We've got great different, there's a lot of variability in soil, actually, from the some of it's more volcanic, some of it's more loamy soils, and so we get a lot of good variation in the expression of Chardonnay from those vineyards out there.
What about in the cellar?
So in
you could screw things up in the cellar. You could be organic outside and quite the opposite inside. It doesn't sound like that would change much. But
no, we do our best in the cellar to we only add what we know is really important to making good wine. You know, we add commercial yeast, but a lot of them are organic yeasts. We feed them properly, and then the wine for Chardonnay stays in beautiful French oak barrels for 10 months. The Cabernet is in French oak barrels as well for about 17 months.
And it's always new oak?
So we use about 50% new French oak in our Chardonnay program and around 70% in our Cabernet program.
Okay. So we're pointing towards a house style.
Absolutely.
I mean, every vintage changes, the crops, all of that. But you strive to have people, when they drink a Far Niente, that they'll understand it's a Far Niente. We may have described it, but let's be a little more specific. What is the style of the Cabernet?
Okay.
And then the Chardonnay. I mean, what are people going to get when they pick it up?
So when you pick up a bottle of Far Niente Cabernet, you're going to know it's Cabernet right away.
Right.
It actually does have...
We're drinking some right now, right?
Yeah.
We have a bottle of the 17.
Yeah.
It's a typical deep, dark, somewhat brooding, you know, dark around the edges. Tell me about the nose quickly.
So for me, I get...
Not too oaky.
It's not too oaky. For me, I get lovely, beautiful black cherry notes. I get a little bit of sort of a licorice anise character that comes up behind it. There's some floral notes. A hint of boysenberry.
Is this nose
through.
We're talking about? Or
this is the nose.
Okay.
Yeah. I haven't had a sip yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
And mouthfeel is, you know, a medium plus. I mean, it's a fairly full wine in your mouth.
Yes, it enters very silky and comes across the palate. It broadens across the mid palate for me. The same flavors are coming through that were in the aromas where I get some nice cherry.
The palate replicates the nose.
Yes,
to a
absolutely.
Good extent.
I get a little bit of some... I get that little bit of anise sort of character coming through towards the finish. Really
is that
fine.
Something in the environs, think, like eucalyptus trees or
no,
anything?
No. I think that's just a classic expression of Cabernet. There's different varying degrees of as you know, there's different varying degrees of herbal notes, and this leans towards that sweeter anise sort of character.
So how do you achieve consistency every year? You'll have great vintages in a row. You'll have a crappy one. You know, we talked about the house style. How do you control that?
So we control, well, the first control is by consistency in your vineyards and having a consistent source of grapes, which we do because we own and farm our own grapes. We try to use the best similar practices every vintage. We have style goals in mind and lots of tools at our fingertips to try to get to that end point.
Right.
And we have a great production team, and we taste together, and we talk about what we talk and taste a lot, and talk about what is Far Niente style. Are we on style with this? Barrel choices, you know, we know what we know. We want a barrel that's not super oaky,
supportive,
adding mouthfeel and texture.
So when you say that, does that vary by manufacturer? Like this manufacturer of a barrel is known to have like this oaky barrel, or is that how you can control
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. So a barrel, there are so many different cooperages and coopers who make barrels from France, and every barrel can be, every cooper has their own special way of making their barrel in terms of bending it, whether they use fire to bend it or water.
And that has an impact.
And that absolutely has an impact. Whether the staves have been aged for 2 years or 3 years. So we do lots of trials and continue to taste new barrels and make sure that we're always using the right barrels for our program.
Now, I should have asked you this earlier, but all the vineyards for Far Niente, because we talked about four other wineries, are all the wines made from estate-grown grapes, or do you take some
So we actually have, in 2017, we started making two different Cabernets. So we have our Napa Valley Cabernet, which has its backbone in our estate vineyards in Oakville. And then we've gone out and found other vineyards with growers that we have long-term relationships right. with out in other of the sub-appellations to make our Napa Valley Cabernet. We also make an Oakville Estate Cabernet. So those ones are 100% from our estate vineyards for the Oakville wine.
So when you're working with outside growers, you lock in long-term relationships
Absolutely.
To make sure. But are you controlling and dictating the practices?
Yes.
That's so part of the arrangement? Like, here's how we want it?
That's absolutely part of the arrangement. So we have an incredible grower relations team and who makes sure is on top of our growers, asking for what we want. You know, winemakers are in the vineyards. We have really good relationships with our growers, and they want to do business with us, and we want to do business with them. And I'd say the majority of the growers are wine drinkers as well.
Right.
So they want to make sure that their grapes are
right.
making excellent wine.
There's a pride
wine.
Factor yeah. in there. So everyone loves to make different kinds of wines. You basically make two wines. Don't you have like this itching desire to make like a Tokaj Friuliano or something crazy, Trousseau, or even Howard your Merlot?
With Chardonnay, I feel very fulfilled because I have so many different vineyards to work with, and there's lots of room for experimentation and trials.
It feels bigger than a singular grape.
Right. And it's a big task to have that many vineyards that are going to make one excellent blend. So, and with the Cabernet, because with our Napa Valley, I'm in different appellations, and so I get that joy out of seeing Cabernet in different spots. We also do a little bit of Merlot and Cabernet Franc and Petit Verdot that will go into the blend. So blending wine.
But those fall under blending. I'm talking about, don't you want to make a Sauvignon Blanc or?
You know, our being in a group of wineries, I get the joy of having other winemaker
right.
colleagues that are doing different varietals or different wines, and we get to taste and talk together, and I get to learn about how they're making it. And so I feel like that's really fulfilling. My absolute best friend at work is the Dolce winemaker, which is a late harvest Botrytis Sémillon.
All Sémillon?
It's Sémillon with a little Sauvignon Blanc. And that is a completely 100% different wine, and yet I get to be with him as he's making those
right.
decisions and tasting, and I feel a lot of pride of the work that he's done, and so I get a lot of fulfillment from that too.
So on the Dolce thing, that's a singular operation.
He's the winemaker.
That's the one product.
One product. It's made at the Farniente facility. With
How long
crew.
Have they been made? It's been like 20 plus.
Yeah, I want to say we just had our 30th consecutive vintage of Dolce.
It's arguably one of the best dessert wines in America, right?
It's the leading dessert wine in America.
All right, so tell me this. When you're not drinking your own wines, when you're not tasting cabs and shards, tell me what you like to drink that has alcohol in it.
I really like champagne.
Okay, yes. I mean, that's...
I'm a tiny bubbles girl.
That's
I like
top
tiny
of
bubbles.
The list,
yeah.
for me at least.
Yeah.
All right, now, any favorites? I mean, do you lean towards grower champagnes? Are you a big house guy?
We're really starting to get into it more. My husband and I just took a trip to... we went to Bordeaux with a group, and then we went to V's for a few days, and ended up visiting a few small grower champagnes and really enjoying that. So we like to try lots of new things.
Champagne. So you have a lot of time and a
yeah.
lot of runway
yeah.
to taste a lot
yeah.
more. What else do you like?
Spirits-wise?
Spirits is fine. Like what?
Okay. Like, we are a Manhattan house, too. We like a good Manhattan.
So is that bitters and rye?
And some sweet vermouth.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're trying different ryes and bitters and all of that? Okay.
Yeah.
Get a buzz a lot quicker than that.
It's a wintertime drink, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And we're shifting to the spring
yeah.
and the summer now, rosé and all of that. What I didn't ask you before is, it's always good to hear from, you know, you guys, the winemaker. With this particular Cabernet, what are like the classic food pairings with it?
Well, I mean...
What are you missing out if you're not having this... cab with what, a bloody burger? I mean, tell me what in your mind.
So I obviously steak is a
okay.
really great pairing,
holds
and I like
well.
and I like a nice filet mignon with this, absolutely. With some roasted vegetables, tend to be really, really great with that. So that's a pretty classic pairing.
That's classic. How about chard?
Chardonnay. We love Chardonnay with lobster and seafood. And actually, we were at a dinner, a supper club dinner the other night here, and there was a Brussels sprout and apple salad that I thought was beautiful with the Chardonnay. And I really liked that pairing. It was really good.
Well. All right, Nicole, we have to wrap up. If anybody wants more information, they can go and Google, or I guess go to farniente.com, F-A-R-N-I-E-N-T-E.
Yes.
.com. I think your social media handles fall under Farniente, you know, @Farniente, yeah. Instagram and all of that. So if you want information, you can get the wine in restaurants.
Absolutely.
You can get it at better retailers. And do you have a whole mailing list program? You can
absolutely
go online.
You can go
clubs.
You can go online. You can buy wine online. We have excellent wine clubs where you actually get wine from all of the different brands. But Chardonnay by the glass in a lot of restaurants.
It's a very popular.
It's a very popular.
I wouldn't say ubiquitous, but it's one of the better wines that's available at a lot of places. Is this your first festival?
It is, and it was my first time to Charleston, actually.
Really?
Yeah,
it was. You got to get out more often, right?
It is a beautiful city, and everybody's been so welcoming and friendly.
Yeah, we hope you come back. I want to thank our guest, Nicole Marchese. She is the winemaker at Farniente Winery in Napa. Thanks for listening to the Heritage Radio Network on Tour. I'm Sam Benrubi from the Grape Nation. Thanks again to the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage possible. Stay tuned for more Charleston wine and food, which is going to be me after Nicole. Thanks again, Nicole.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.